We're back on the air. This is Radio Entrepreneurs, the radio show that's always dedicated to the stories of entrepreneurship and helping to create greater success around entrepreneurship. Want to thank our friends all week long this week over at the law firm of Tarlow, Breed, Hart & Rogers, located at the lovely Prudential Center in Boston, Massachusetts. And my co-host for this segment is Mark Furman, our business and law reporter on the Radio Entrepreneurs. Thank you again, Mark.
My pleasure, Jeffrey. Great to be with you.
What do we call this segment? Furman on Furman.
Oh, my goodness.
We're going to be interviewing Matt Furman to talk about the new law just signed into being, Defend Trade Secrets Act, correct?
That's right, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Great. I'll let your father drill you.
Hi.
Okay.
Hi.
What is the Defend Trade Secrets Act? Because it's pretty fresh out of the oven, right?
That's right. So something actually happened in Washington recently. Congress passed, and on May 11, President Obama signed into law the Defend Trade Secrets Act of 2016, which is the first federal level protection or regulation of trade secrets we've ever had in this country. Up till now, it's been a state-specific law, and obviously when you have state-specific law, you have different rules in Rhode Island than Massachusetts than New Hampshire. So there was no sort of uniform protection. When we're talking about trade secrets, we're talking about formulas, methods, customer lists. When I was in law school, the classic example of a trade secret they gave you was the formula to make Coca-Cola.
Right.
That's sort of the simple
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
That's exactly right. What makes that so much better than the fried chicken you make in your kitchen, Jeffrey?
I don't. My wife, the chef, does. Never made fried chicken. That's one thing I've not attempted.
Well, I don't think you could do it the way the Colonel does, at least.
No way.
And that's because of the Colonel's trade secrets.
Right.
So there are two, in my opinion, sort of interesting and different provisions in this law that are going to be a change. The first is an ex parte seizure procedure. So an employer, if an employee was leaving, could go into court without giving notice to the employee and get a court order requiring government officials to seize the trade secrets. Somebody's running out with the Coca-Cola formula. You could get the government to go chase it and take it away from them on your own without giving notice. So that is different. That's never been available in any state's trade secret laws in the past. I don't think it's been available in any intellectual property provisions in the past of any type. And it's a total experiment. So, you know, we're going to see how that works. But it is unique and different.
It's you know, in general, our whole legal system is premised on the idea of people have notice and an opportunity to be heard. And sometimes the due process clause of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution requires notice and an opportunity to be heard before action can be taken by the government. Now, there are exceptions, but they truly relate to emergencies that if notice is given, that the asset will be disposed of, hidden, won't be able to be retrieved. So this sounds like it could be a little broadening of when relief can be obtained without notice.
That's right, at least on a temporary basis. So it's different. I think part of my understanding is part of the reasons that this law is now in place and this provision is sort of online piracy by foreign governments, foreign actors.
Which is quite common.
Which is increasingly common as technology develops, and for every step of protection that gets made, a new way around it is developed. So it's going to be interesting to see how the government actually enforces something like these seizure provisions if we're dealing with It's one thing to take the thumb drive out of somebody's hands, but if it's already been transmitted back to a different, to China or something, it's...
Well, that's, you know, I once heard a statistic that for every one computer science graduate in this country, there was something like 20,000 in China. And so...
Well, that's probably right.
And if there's 20,000 in China, and if you're a brilliant hacker in China, you get a nice apartment and car, and they hire you to do that. I mean, I'm just wondering how we really going to be able to stop them. I understand the principle is there to stop them now, because it does take a national effort to really stop international espionage. But how do we really stop them? Is this going to work, or is this a superficial Band-Aid? I don't know if I'm allowed to ask you an opinion about that.
Well, I mean, it struck me, and Mark, I'd be curious what you think too, but it struck me as it could, in certain circumstances, be a paper tiger, you know, right. Sort of a... And even if it could be done, that's sort of the, right. To use another analogy, the egg could be unscrambled. At what cost? How much is our...
So you litigate here in Massachusetts and you win, but that person's still sitting in China doing what they want to do.
That's right.
Mark that's is a, nodding for the radio show.
That's a problem.
See it on the video.
You know, that's a problem in enforcing orders when you cross state lines, when you cross international boundaries. It's you know, it's just one of the challenges. So you said there were a couple interesting points. What were the other?
The other one I wanted to bring up that I thought would be of particular interest to entrepreneurs is this whistleblower immunity notice obligation they put on employers. So the Defend Trade Secrets Act includes immunity for whistleblowers. People that report to the government of what they view as a misappropriation of trade secrets. So there's an affirmative obligation put on employers in this act to notify people of these whistleblower immunities. And if an employer fails to put them in the employment contract, the employment manual, or some other place that is made clear to the employee, then to the extent that employee, the employer accuses that employee of misappropriating trade secrets, it puts a limit on what the employer can recover in a suit against them. Normally, they'd be able to recover their attorney's fees. They can't do so. Normally, they'd be able to recover exemplary or punitive damages. If they don't put those notices in the contract, they can't do so. So it's a sort of a trap for unwary employers and an interesting affirmative obligation to properly protect your own trade secrets. Historically in the law, they talk about steps you need to take to try to keep a trade secret private in order for it to be considered a trade secret. Here's, assuming you did all that, here's something else you have to do to recover what you've lost in a situation where an employee has stolen the customer list or the Coca-Cola formula.
You know, the whole thing for me, I'm trying to understand it politically, and I'm not sure I will for another 5 years, because I'm wondering, is this a political move to just make a statement, or is this a first step in what's going to need to be a series of steps, or is it like a multiple choice, it's A and B?
Well, you know, It's strange to say this in 2016. I think the vote in Congress was like 410-2 to pass this law.
Really?
And the president had indicated he was going to sign it. So I think our trade secret law was just sort of stuck in the 80s, basically.
Right.
And you know, this might be a step into the 90s, but
great.
But you know, not bad for government work,
right?
So, well, I mean, I think from the point of view of business owners, you know, protecting your confidential information, which is really what we're talking about, is one of the three things that I think you really have to think about in this new act. Gives federal court jurisdiction really for the first time as a matter of right to bring cases where your trade secrets have been stolen. But employers should also think about a couple other types of agreements to put in their employment contracts with employees, and that is non-solicitation agreements. Don't solicit customers, don't solicit employees. And then the more controversial one today is the non-compete agreements, which are generally illegal, unenforceable in California, for example, but are enforceable in states like Massachusetts to the extent they're reasonable in scope and duration. But there have been a number of legislative proposals the last few years to make non-competes unenforceable. So I think business owners really need to think about what agreements they need with employees that, you know, before they hire people. If you present these agreements to employees after they've already decided to join your company, they may not be enforceable. That's one of the issues.
I'm seeing that right now where a company I work with, very successful company, national company, had a very senior hire, had some ambitions of doing something, and that hire is not exactly what they want to do 11 months into it. And everything was done on a promise. And there was nothing that was really, there was some stuff that was documented, but the documented stuff makes it almost worse that it wasn't more clearly stated from the not just the beginning. And you've talked about this with me a lot over the years, Mark, not just the beginning of the relationship, but how the end of the relationship should look. And I think a lot of people don't look at the end at the beginning, and you need to. And I think you've tried to, you know, encourage me to look at that in my work. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, hopefully there's great optimism at the beginning of every business relationship, whether it's a vendor relationship, whether it's a partner relationship, whether it's an employee relationship. But you have to ask the question, well, what happens if things don't work out? And you don't want to find out that you're stuck with a set of legal obligations at the end that you really would never have agreed to at the beginning. So so I think that's right.
Matt, good topic. I assume you're going to stay on top of it and report back to us when things move along into reality.
I'm looking forward to it, Jeffrey.
Great. If someone wants to talk to you about this type of topic, they're doing business overseas, internationally, they have patents, they have stuff, material they have to protect, how do they find you?
Sure, they can find me here at Tarlow, Breed, Hart & Rogers. We're in the Prudential Center, but give me a call at 617-218-2000. Or find me on LinkedIn.
Well, I had unrealistic expectations before this interview. I thought that Mark Furman, the litigator, was going to go after Matt Furman, the business attorney right now, but it really didn't come to fruition. Yeah, and litigator. So I was unrealistic in my expectations. It's happened before in my life, but I was hoping it was going to be a little bit, you know.
Our family's too functional for that, Jeffrey.
Oh, wow. With that note, I want to thank our friends over at Tarlow, Breed, Hart & Rogers who are hosting us all week long. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after these messages on Radio Entrepreneurs.